Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey friends, welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. This is the weekly highlight reel of videos that I have put out on YouTube. So in case you don't know, you can go over to YouTube and watch all of my videos. The channel is History and Coffee, and you can just search for my name as well, Heather Tesco, History and Coffee, and you will get it. And you can subscribe there. Thank you to the many people who already subscribe. And then what I've started doing is weekly highlight reels of some of the videos that have gone out on YouTube that would be of interest to the podcast listeners as well. So thanks for listening. And you can also, like I said, go over and join me on YouTube, History and Coffee, and search for Heather. And there I am. So let's get right into it. Today, we are talking about Henry VIII's children. He had three children, right? Oh, no. There might be a lot more. Well, half a dozen more. We are going to talk today about Henry VIII's illegitimate children that he had. Of course, a lot of them, they're alleged. There's only one that he acknowledged, but there's some interesting stories behind the others as well. So we're going to dig into that. I actually did do a video last week, maybe the week before, on Henry Fitzroy, who's the one acknowledged illegitimate child. So we're going to kind of skip over him very briefly. Talk about him very briefly, but then we'll dig into the others. Also, I'm thinking about turning this into a whole podcast, digging really deep. This is kind of just a short overview. If you think this would make a good podcast episode, let me know in the comments and I will do a deeper dive into them, okay? All right. In the intricate tapestry of Tudor England, legitimacy was more than a matter of birthright. It was a symbol of power, of stability, and of divine right. The idea was that royal blood carried sanctity, and the very essence of the monarchy depended on a clear line of succession. So illegitimate children were considered outsiders, barred often from the inner circles of nobility, and denied the birthright privileges of their legitimate counterparts. Of course, this is because it could be a threat to the monarchy itself, right? So the strict adherence to legitimacy was grounded in both politics and religion. The Middle Ages and early Renaissance period, of course, held up the sanctity of marriage and viewed children born outside of the marital confines as tainted. In the realm of politics, legitimacy ensured the undisputed right to the throne, preventing civil unrest and claims from rival factions, at least in theory. Remember, the Wars of the Roses was still quite fresh in everyone's minds around this time. So an illegitimate child, especially one born to a king, was a very controversial figure, both pitied, potentially powerful. Their very existence raised questions of morality, of succession, of political maneuvering, making them subjects of intrigue and speculation in courtly circles. So first, we're going to talk about the Carey family, consisting of Catherine Carey and Henry Carey. This has long been a point of intrigue and speculation when it comes to the potential illegitimate children of Henry VIII. Catherine Carey was born in 1524, the daughter of William Carey and Mary Boleyn, Henry's infamous mistress, the sister of Anne Boleyn. The timing of Catherine's birth and the nature of the relationship between Mary and Henry has led many to suggest that Mary could be, has led many to suggest that Catherine could be Henry's daughter. However, of course, there's no concrete proof of this. It's entirely possible that she was born after Mary's relationship with the king had ended. Her brother Henry's birth, also born in 1526, is also cloaked in similar rumors. Henry was born during a period when Mary's relationship with the king was likely ongoing. Due to the close timing and Henry's subsequent favorable treatment in court, even his name, there's been lots of speculation through the years. There was at the time, and there still is, about his paternity. He was later made Baron Hudson by his cousin, Queen Elizabeth I. Cousin anyway, because she would have been, Elizabeth was the daughter of Anne. And so it might be that it was his half-sister, but also his cousin. All gets very complicated. Elizabeth also offered him the Earl of Ormond on his deathbed, a title associated with his maternal family, the Boleyn. What adds another layer of interest to these speculations is the fact that both Catherine and Henry bore a noticeable resemblance to Henry VIII. The resemblance was even more pronounced in Catherine's daughter, Elizabeth Knowles, who was said to be so similar in appearance to Elizabeth I that she was often mistaken for her. Despite the whispers and rumors, neither Catherine nor Henry Carey were ever publicly acknowledged by Henry VIII as his children. The lack of official acknowledgement may have been influenced by political implications at the time, particularly given the sensitive nature of the Boleyn family with the crown. Whether descended from a king or not, the Careys remain an intriguing footnote. Now let's talk about four other potential children of Henry VIII. The first is Thomas Stukely. His mother was Jane Pollard, and he was an English mercenary who fought in France and Ireland and at the Battle of Lepanto. I did a whole episode on the Battle of Lepanto a couple of years ago. He was killed in the Battle of Alcazar, fighting the army in Morocco. He was a Roman Catholic recusant and a rebel against Elizabeth I. His mother, Jane Pollard, was the member of a prominent Devon family, and she is believed to have had a relationship with Henry VIII before her marriage. The rumors of Thomas being Henry's son largely come from his own claims. He allegedly boasted about his royal blood, though there's no concrete evidence to support this. His adventurous spirit and his audacious character might have further evoked comparisons to the young Henry VIII, fueling further speculation. Next comes Richard Edwards. His mother was Agnes Edwards. He was an English poet, playwright, and composer. He was a gentleman of the Chapel Royal. He was a master of the singing boys. He was known for his comedies and his interludes, and he received a lot of patronage, showing a high level of royal favor. So rumors persisted, likely because of his rapid rise in the court and his artistic talents, which mirrored those of the king. Some contemporary sources hint at a possible lineage with Henry, but direct evidence remains elusive. The next one is Ethelreda Mault. She's also called Audrey. Her mother was Joan Dingley. Audrey was acknowledged as the daughter of a John Mault, who was Henry VIII's tailor. However, her father's will, John's will, hinted at a royal connection. He left her a fair amount of money, which he said that Henry VIII had given him, and Henry had given him special grants when he accepted her as his daughter. So his will, provided generously for Audrey, contained a telling phrase. It referred to her as being reputed to be his daughter. This, along with land grants linked to properties that were historically connected to the Boleyn family, led many to speculate that she was Henry's daughter. Finally, we have John Perrot. His mother was Mary Barclay, the wife of Sir Thomas Perrot. He served as Lord Deputy of Ireland and had a tumultuous relationship with the crown, eventually being imprisoned for treason. The rumor mill largely focused on John's supposed resemblance to Henry VIII, both physically and in temperament. Contemporary sources, including Sir Robert Naunton's Fragmenta Regalia, suggest that Perrot was the king's son, citing his behavior and physical likeness as evidence. While none of these figures was acknowledged by Henry VIII, the swirling rumors and their various connections at the royal court ensured that they remained subjects of intrigue and speculation in the annals of Tudor history. It should be noted that most modern historians reject John Perrot, especially as being the son of Henry VIII. But throughout most of history, people did suspect that there was a link there. The intrigue surrounding Henry VIII's possible unacknowledged children remains a tantalizing puzzle for historians. Of course, there was no DNA testing available during the Tudor era. Much of what we know about these potential heirs comes from written records and gossip, and sometimes the very silence of historical texts. Some factors come into play when considering the legitimacy of these claims. First, Henry's personality was such that if he believed any of these children were his, he might have acknowledged them the way he did with Henry Fitzroy. His failure to do so casts doubt on these claims. However, of course, the political landscape was complex, and acknowledging an illegitimate child could pose a threat to the line of succession, especially during times when Henry's legitimate heirs were in question. The king's acknowledgement might also have given the child and their maternal family a significant boost in status and power, which could disrupt the delicate balance of power at court. Finally, the mothers of these children and their proximity to the king during the speculated times can offer some clues. Some had clear access to the king, while others seem more distant. While we may never know the full truth, the story of these individuals and their potential links to the throne add depth to the already complex tapestry of Tudor history. Today, we're going to have fun with a bit of alternate history. What if the big event of the summer of 1588 had gone the other way for England? What if the Spanish had won? So, in 1588, the world stood still as two mighty powers, England and Spain, collided in a naval battle that would reshape the course of European history. But what if the winds had shifted, the tide had turned, and the English fleet had been defeated? Today, let's explore an alternative narrative, the one where the Spanish Armada succeeded. First, let's step back a bit to truly grasp the context. England, under the Protestant Queen Elizabeth I, had become a thorn in the side of Catholic Spain. Beyond religious differences, tensions were further inflamed by the English piracy and interference in the Spanish Netherlands. Spain's King Philip II, motivated by a mix of religious fervor, political ambition, and personal indignation, amassed a fleet formidable in size and reputation. This fleet, the Spanish Armada, was entrusted with the mission of escorting an army from Flanders to invade England. The vast armada consisted of about 130 ships, which carried over 8,000 sailors and possibly as many as 19,000 soldiers. Its aim? To overthrow Queen Elizabeth I and restore Catholicism in England. England, on the other hand, while outnumbered in ships, relied heavily on superior maneuverability, innovative tactics, and the home advantage. In our known history, this was put to the test when the two forces met in the English Channel. As the ships clashed and the cannons roared, a series of English victories combined with unfavorable weather conditions ultimately led to the Armada's defeat. The winds, quite literally, were not in Spain's favor. A combination of strategic English fireships, skirmishes, and the infamous Protestant wind forced the Armada to retreat, leading many ships to be wrecked in storms off the coasts of Scotland and Ireland. The aftermath of this decisive event was clear. England emerged as the dominant naval power. Elizabeth's reign entered a golden age of exploration, arts, and prosperity. The tide of influence had shifted in Europe, with England now gaining newfound respect and asserting its dominance. However, let's consider a different twist to this tale. Let's imagine for a moment if the Spanish Armada, bolstered by a strategic advantage or simply the winds blowing a different way, emerged victorious. What would England look like under Spanish rule? What if Protestantism was suppressed and Catholicism reigned supreme? Would Shakespeare's plays carry echoes of Spanish sonnets? Would the English and Spanish crowns eventually merge? History lovers are guided by evidence and facts, but we often find ourselves pondering the infinite possibilities that lie in the questions of what if and why not, don't we? I do, don't you? It's a tantalizing, super fun exercise that, though speculative, allows us to reflect on the intricate web of decisions, actions, and sheer chance that shapes the course of history. So in our exploration today, we're going to pinpoint the moment our historical timeline would diverge. So as the Spanish were regrouping off the coast on the other side of the English Channel, the English sent fire ships. And that was really the decisive factor that caused the whole fleet to have to scatter, right? So let's imagine that a key English fire ship failed to ignite, or perhaps a sudden calm settles on the waters, halting the fateful push of the Protestant wind, giving the Spanish fleet the upper hand. English coastlines would have seen the shores darken with Spanish ships. Queen Elizabeth I, who had held her realm together through political guile and a will of iron, might have been captured, or maybe she was forced into exile. England, with its relatively weaker land force, could have been quickly occupied. The Tudor dynasty would have faced an abrupt and ignoble end. Religion would have been at the forefront of the changes. With King Philip II's deep Catholic convictions, one of the first mandates might have been the swift reversion of England to Catholicism. The Protestant Reformation, which had deeply rooted itself during Henry VIII and Elizabeth I's reigns, would now face a severe backlash. Protestants, seen as heretics, might be persecuted or forced to practice in secret the way the Catholics currently had been, leading to an underground religious movement. London, the heart of England, might witness the construction of cathedrals and monuments that had a touch of Spanish architecture. Maybe Protestant leaders would now be in the Tower of London, making it a darker place than it already was in our known history. But history is shaped not just by battles and monarchs. It's the people, their cultures, their everyday lives that truly paint the canvas of time. And England under Spanish rule would see a fascinating blend of cultures. And this had happened before when the French invaded in 1066 and when the Viking invasions had happened and, you know, the Germanic invasions after Rome left. We saw this blending of cultures. So it's not something that is completely unknown. England was known for its adaptability. And, you know, you just look at the English language as it is right now and all of the different foreign words that mixed together to make this very unique language. So we probably would have absorbed more Spanish words. The theaters, which gave birth to Shakespeare's tragedies and comedies, might now showcase plays bearing the influence of Spain's own Golden Age writers like Lope de Vega or Calderón de la Barca. The arts, a reflection of society's soul, would be transformed. English portraits, once stiff and formal under Holbein, might adopt the warm, passionate tones seen in Spanish art. In music, the lute could be accompanied by the Spanish guitarra, creating harmonies that echo both the green fields of England and the sun-baked plains of Andalusia. And let's not forget the culinary delights. English alehouses might introduce tapas alongside traditional pies. Perhaps the English afternoon tea eventually these days would see a hint of churros and chocolate. That would be amazing. As Spain's grip on England tightens, the structure of power begins to shift. The English aristocracy, once dominant, now finds itself in a precarious position. Some, seeing the writing on the wall, might seek alliances with their new Spanish overlords, while others, loyal to the Tudor legacy and Protestant faith, could form the nucleus of a nascent resistance. And that's what we saw under William the Conqueror, too. Some of the nobility said, okay, we'll go along with this. And some fought back, and then those were replaced by French people, or Norman people, I should say, just to make that clear. So again, this is just kind of going off of what had happened before and what humanity is most likely to do, right? So England's common law system, which had been evolving since the days of King John and the Magna Carta, might now be influenced by the Spanish Leyes de las Indias. This blend could lead to a judicial system that marries the precedent-based English system with the codified regulations of the Spanish. That would be interesting. In the shadows of the halls and down the winding alleyways, whispers of rebellion might grow. Secret societies dedicated to the restoration of Elizabeth or her Protestant successor could spring to life. These underground movements, fueled by a sense of nationalism and religious fervor, would lay the groundwork for potential uprisings in the future. And, you know, maybe Scotland and France would unite because, of course, James would have still been in Scotland. He was the heir apparent. Perhaps France and Scotland would have united to invade from the north, and Spain would have had another war on their hands up in the northern part of England, with perhaps the resistance fighting there. The joining of these two naval superpowers would undoubtedly alter the course of exploration and colonization. A combined English-Spanish fleet could sail further and faster, perhaps altering the balance of power in the New World. Instead of clashing interests in places like the Caribbean, these two nations might cooperate, changing the borders of future nations in the Americas. Trade routes would be redefined. The wool and cloth exports of England could find new markets in Spanish territories, while the treasures of the Spanish Main, the gold and silver, would flow not just to Sevilla, but also London. This shared wealth could usher in an era of prosperity, possibly bringing about an earlier industrial revolution powered by both Spanish bullion and English ingenuity. However, Europe, a continent that is no stranger to wars and intrigue, would have had to recalibrate its strategies. A Spain-England union, both powerful and resource-rich, could become a magnet for coalitions. Wars might be fought not in the fields of England or the coast of Spain, but also in far-flung territories as other European powers vie for a piece of the global pie. As ripples spread out when a stone is dropped into a pond, so would the consequences of a Spanish victory reverberate through time. The 30 Years' War, a devastating conflict rooted in religious tensions, might see different alliances. Perhaps England under Spanish influence might not see the rise of Cromwell and the Puritans, thereby preventing the English Civil War. The Renaissance, blossoming in Italy, would reach new heights as Spanish and English patrons, flush with the combined wealth of the two empires, patronized the arts, sciences, and thinkers. We might find a world where Galileo, Newton, and Cervantes all find common patrons, and other people that we haven't heard of would have had patronage, leading to a vibrant intermingling of ideas and cultures. Yet not all the changes would be rosy. The suppressed Protestant movements could lead to large migrations, perhaps strengthening the Protestant colonies in the New World and changing the religious demographics of entire continents. Let's imagine we arrive in modern-day England, shaped by centuries of Spanish influence. The skylines of London and Manchester are punctuated not just by the Gothic cathedrals, but also the intricate designs of the Spanish Baroque architecture. Imagine hearing a seamless blend of English and Spanish as you walk down the streets. Schools might teach the combined histories of the Spanish conquistadors and English explorers, offering a richer tapestry of shared heritage. Cuisine would be a delightful amalgamation of the two cultures. Traditional English breakfast might come with a side of a Spanish omelet, and paella could be a regular dish at Sunday family gatherings. Imagine football having a unified league, leading to matchups, regular matchups between teams like Real Madrid and Manchester United. As we journey back to our reality, we're reminded, of course, of the fragile nature of history. Each moment, every decision plays a pivotal role in shaping our present. While we've indulged in a fun what-if scenario, it's essential to appreciate the true course of events that have made our world what it is today. History is more than just facts and dates. It's an ever-evolving narrative that teaches us about resilience, ambition, conflict, and harmony. In exploring alternate realities, we gain a deeper appreciation for the intricate dance of circumstances, choices, and chance that crafts our shared human story. Thank you so much for joining me on this historical voyage of imagination. If you found the journey as intriguing as I did, I would love to hear your thoughts. How do you envision an alternate England? What other historical turning points pique your curiosity? Thanks so much for listening to this week's YouTube highlights. Remember, you can go over and subscribe. History and Coffee, Heather Tesco, you will find me there. And we'll be back again next week with more highlights from what went out on YouTube throughout the week. Thanks so much. Have a great week. Blow, northern wind,
scent of baby sweating, blow northern wind, blow, blow, blow.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.